This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It has been 10 months since the U.S. withdrew troops from Afghanistan. Roughly 2,000 Afghan refugees have resettled in Massachusetts as of March, fleeing violence and uncertainty in their home country. Among them, brothers Shakib and Wadan Malakzai. The brothers came here with their wives and children, leaving behind close family members. Their mother passed away back in Afghanistan after they arrived. Their father, as a member of the Afghanistan Police Force, has been in hiding in Afghanistan since the Taliban took over. We sat down with Shakib and Wadan last week, and Shakib told us the decision to leave wasn't easy.
Very difficult. Yes, very, very hard. But yes, I miss my Afghanistan, my country. I very miss.
The brothers are now living in Worcester as they try to piece their lives back together.
I am living the third floor.
And Shakib, do you live nearby?
Yes. First apartment mine and second to American person. It's very good. I'm so happy.
They're also working in the janitorial department at the UMass Chan Medical School in Worcester as part of a new program. It helps recently resettled Afghan refugees find jobs at the medical school based on their career skills from their home country. They're two of four refugees so far who have found employment through the program. And Shakib says having a job is crucial right now.
Very important for me, ma'am, very important. I have 2 7 children. Working, very important for me.
Combined, Shakib and Wadan have 12 children, with Wadan and his wife expecting another any day now. Shakib and Wadan have been getting support through the Worcester Islamic Center. Dr. Muhammad Ramzan is an assistant professor of neurology at the UMass Chan Medical School and also the director of social services at the center. He was with Shakib and Wadan when we talked, helping translate at times, and he told us a little more about their transition from Afghanistan to America.
We have been in connection with them to help them out through Worcester Islamic Center Social Services. And obviously, these folks were looking for certain jobs. Then I came across Dr. Jeff Carson, who is working at UMass Chan Medical School. And he had his own experience visiting Afghanistan also. And our plan was to get them hired and help them out to get some job. And this is how we started on this journey with interviews and paperwork and eventually them starting the job over there.
And what has been a pleasant or happy surprise since you came here, Wadan?
Safety
is the most important thing, that once they landed here, they felt that they were in safe hands now.
Shakib, is that the same for you?
Yes. My family, all family safe. My children, good study. Good school here, but not good school to Afghanistan. Everything is very good.
Dr. Ramzan, has that been your experience with the Worcester Islamic Center, that the community has been welcoming and people have stepped up to help those coming from Afghanistan?
Community, yeah, indeed. We were very surprised and happy also that everybody came forward to help them out, because this was a crisis for the resettlement agencies. The influx was so huge and so sudden that they couldn't manage the workload and the people, how they came in hundreds, literally. In Worcester area, there were more than 700 people who had arrived, and these resettlement agencies were really in a very tough situation. So our community stepped forward, so we can help them in any possible way with the food, with shelter, with the schooling, bring their youth here so that they can be connected with our youth here, you know, give them some spiritual venue where they can talk to Imam, meet people of the community and come here, because they were initially in hotels and not enough room for them to really socialize and intermingle. And they were in a shock, in a cultural shock, as well as a lot of stress as they had left their families behind. So when we opened the doors for them, they were quite happy and pleased to meet each other in an open environment and also to meet other community members.
Shakib and Wadan say they are hopeful for their future in the U.S. with the support of the center, a future for them and their families.
Right now, my family is happy for my kids and school going to happy. And I want to my kids study and writing.
I happy here for my children. Good study here. Very good study. And for me also, I right now I busy for working. I'm so happy, my family happy.
That was Shakib and Wadan Malekzai, refugees who have resettled in Worcester after leaving Afghanistan last fall. You also heard Dr. Mohammed Ramzan, an assistant professor of neurology at the UMass Chan Medical School and director of social services at the Worcester Islamic Center. During that conversation, Dr. Ramzan mentioned Jeff Carson, who's the assistant vice chancellor of human resources at UMass Chan Medical School. Jeff Carson joins us now to talk more about this program. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
A pleasure. Thank you.
So first, I just want to give you a chance to react to the conversation you heard there, especially from two brothers who have been a part of this program you helped create.
Yeah, super powerful. My time and experience in Afghanistan started in 2009 when I was served my second combat tour in around Kunduz, and then returned home and started a think tank doing research for Congress on Afghanistan, returned back and with the State Department to Kabul with the State Department there. So I had experience with working with, seeing the sacrifices of the Afghans on behalf of the United States and our cause. So fast forward to 2022, as I'm in this position at UMass Chan, and I heard a WBOR report that we had resettled a number of Afghans in Worcester, and you know, being in human resources, understanding the situation, the labor shortage that, well, not just UMass Chan, but across the U.S. and the world is in, I thought this is a great opportunity for us to help serve, grow, invest in the Afghans and in Worcester. So I reached out to the Worcester Islamic Center, and it just so happened that Dr. Ramzan, who's in the neurology department at UMass Memorial, also by night runs the Worcester Islamic Center. So we just started this remarkable partnership to, you know, bring the Afghans to UMass Chan Medical School and try to find positions for them.
So you served in the U.S. Army, just for our listeners. You just talked about one of your tours. How long were you in the Army, and how many countries did you see?
Yeah, sure. I've been in for 26 years. I'm still in. I'm in the Army Reserves, assigned to West Point now. And I was there at an outpost for a year in Kunduz, embedded with the Afghan National Army. So embedded operations are generally 20 U.S. soldiers embedded with around 150 Afghans. And before that, I was in Iraq for a year in Mosul. So you know, being an embedded is certainly this unique opportunity that you have to just really live, eat, train, fight with Afghans in a way that normally conventional forces don't. So my experience with them, just really understanding who they are and their culture and their work ethic, you know, allowed me to just really feel like a sense of purpose once I, you know, heard that the resettlement, Worcester was one of the places that resettled this, the Afghans.
So how does it work, Jeff? How does the program work, and how many people are you hoping to serve?
Yeah, so, well, it's very organic. So, you know, once this is probably 2 months ago that I caught the WBR story, and then I reached out to, you know, my boss, and she sent an email right up the chain, and I watched it go straight to the top to Chancellor Collins and straight down through the dean, John Lindstedt and Deb Hornois, and they said with enthusiasm, you know, build something, do it, make it happen. So with that, I just worked with the Worcester Islamic Center and the talent recruitment team at UMass Chan to bring waves of them in to sit down, talk to them, assess their skills, what certificates they have, what they did in Afghanistan, where we can place them at UMass Chan Medical School. But, you know, it's an investment. So, you know, we have to understand that, you know, they didn't come with resumes or, you know, email accounts necessarily established. So, you know, we were helping them help themselves along the way. Again, it was an investment in not only UMass Chan, but also in Worcester and the Afghans that had just come here. We had to, you know, think differently.
So, you know, we get rare opportunities like this, Jeff, to talk to somebody with deep lived experience in the service in Afghanistan, here trying to support refugee resettlement. You know, I'm kind of thinking about the threads of your heart and how they must connect to what you saw unfold last summer as we were leaving Afghanistan, and then these deep one-on-one conversations now as you try to match skills, aspirations of people we're supporting here. Are you trying to make sure that we support our Afghan members of our community the way you would want it to happen if the tables were turned? And how far off from there are we? Do you understand my question?
Yeah, sure. You know, to me, you know, their sacrifices were no different than my sacrifices in Afghanistan. You know, we went over there and we tried to do something, and they were a partner with us in it. So, you know, now that I'm in the position that I'm in and I have an opportunity to you know, make sure that the folks that have sacrificed and it didn't work out for them and they were going to become a target of the Taliban that came and they came here, that we can invest in them on the other side. I'm a third generation immigrant. So, you know, the story of Afghans goes certainly beyond the fact that I did serve a combat tour with them there, and I did go with serve at the State Department in Kabul, but also myself as a third generation immigrant that you know, understands that these folks have a work ethic. They want to be a part of this great experiment called America, and I can be a part in helping them. And three generations from now, you know, hopefully UMass Chan Medical School will be a part of that generation story for the Afghans.
What's been the most joyful part the last couple of months as you've built this?
Well, you know, seeing our leadership at UMass Chan was remarkable. You know, the amount of enthusiasm they had to allow me to build something very entrepreneurial and organic made me proud to be a part of the institution. I can't stress that enough. There's, you know, from the Vice Chancellor of Human Resources all the way up to the Chancellor, Chancellor Collins, they were just so supportive of this, what we're talking about right now. And I think that's a good story out there.
So what's been hard that shouldn't be, either in trying to do this to support people like Shakib and Wadan, or the experience they're having coming to the United States and trying to resettle?
Well, you know, I think that, you know, more institutions are missing out on great opportunities. You know, there's a lot of Afghans that have resettled, not just in Worcester, across the United States of America. And, you know, this is an opportunity for institutions, employers to invest in Afghans, invest in America. But it's going to take work. You know, they're coming to us, you know, hopping through three different countries and a couple military bases and living in hotels.
For months sometimes, right?
Exactly. I mean, this is not a normal, you know, college grad with 3 to 5 years experience, but they have work ethic and they want to be a part of America. But it's going to take up an investment on an employer's part to get them there, right? And that's not that's a long-term investment that's going to pay dividends and yields years and years later. What UMass Chan is doing is powerful. I would love to see that in scale across America. We need that not just for the Afghans, but for America.
So we're looking at a number of roughly 2,000 folks resettled from Afghanistan, including about 600 in the Worcester area. I've got to assume that there's actually a broad range of professional experience, broad range of education, broad range of previous work. And I wonder if we're also under-creating opportunities to take advantage of those skills and talents, Jeff.
Yeah, absolutely. And me and Dr. Ramzan had a lot of conversations at nights, weekends, about this right there. Okay, they were nurses in Afghanistan. Let's get them in the system. Let's get them employed, and then let's work them and invest in them to get up to where they were and what they did before. We had an Afghan that was interviewing with us, and he was a pilot in Afghanistan, right? I mean, but it takes a little bit of time to get the certifications and the qualifications transferred over. But that's to your earlier question and to my answer, which is, you know, there's a lot there. It just takes a little bit of investment by the institution, by the employer, by America, to help them.
You mentioned three generations from now. You hope UMass Chan is a part of this story. Let's look closer. 6 months from now, how do you know if you've succeeded? What does success look like?
You know, I just want to continue to create a pipeline that brings more and more of the Afghans that have resettled into our institution at UMass Chan, and help other institutions in Worcester that want to call and ask about our experience and how they can be a part of it. I'm certain that there are other institutions that are searching for employees. You know, there's a labor shortage, as we all know. But there's folks that may be a little hesitant to take the risk. I think success is if we can keep building upon more and more of these Afghans, you know, embedding themselves into Worcester, into employment and serving their community, which is what they want to do.
All right. That is Jeff Carson, Assistant Vice Chancellor of Human Resources at UMass Chan Medical School. Jeff, thanks so much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you. Have a good day.
Are you stressed? Okay. Statistically speaking, the answer is probably yes. During COVID-19, the American Psychological Association found that Americans reported significantly higher stress than at any time since 2007, which was the first year of the survey. And by the way, the start of the Great Recession that year. And frankly, given what we've been through collectively in the last couple of years, it's not really surprising. My laugh there was sort of a laugh of resignation, less than humor. So in today's installment of Be Well, we are going to try to de-stress, and we'd love to hear from you. You can tweet us, or if you're in our texting group, you can text us. Are you more stressed lately? How are you handling it? Do you have questions for coping? Tweet us at Radio Boston, or if you're in the texting group, remember that number is 617-766-0382. That's 617-766-0382. We're going to start this conversation with Adolfo Cuevas, who is a community psychologist and assistant professor of community health at Tufts University. Adolfo, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So how stressed are we?
I think we're all very stressed. And I think there's an important caveat to say here, because as my mentor would say, if you're not stressed, you're a person that's not living. Stress is an important part of your day-to-day life. What we're trying to really convey is how distressed people are. There's a level of stress that's really outside of our comfort. And that is actually becoming a huge public health issue in the United States. And this is something that we have to deal with, not only at the individual level, but also as a society. How can we actually develop policies, interventions to actually deal with people who are in psychological distress?
So let's pull that apart a little bit. You said a minute ago, you know, if we're really distressed, that's a level that's outside of our comfort. I say this only half playfully. I am never comfortable when I'm stressed. I thought stress was a signal to our body that we're in an uncomfortable situation. So how do you tell the difference between what would be sort of a normal and healthy amount of stress and something that is truly a kind of distress that would be bad for you?
Well, and you just hit it right there, something that's actually uncomfortable to the person. And so that actually is an individual level perception of what stress is. Because really, the definition of stress is a physiological and behavioral response to internal or external stressors. And stressors are different day-to-day events that are manifesting or occurring in our lives. Now, when we're talking about what actually is or creating this level of discomfort is based on our perception, what's outside of our own coping mechanism, outside of our own psychosocial resources that actually helps combat those stressors.
And
that's stress.
What's happening in our body? What is the physiology of stress?
So this is the example I give in my class where imagine there is a lion that walks into this room.
No, thank you.
No, thank you, right? Well, there are two things that you could actually do. You could actually run or you could actually fight the lion, which I don't recommend. I think the best way to actually survive that situation is run. But what's actually happening physiologically is that there's this huge, huge hormone release of epinephrine and norepinephrine. This is what we typically call adrenaline. And this allows us to mobilize and run away or fight the lion. Our society, you know, this actually helped us survive as cave people hundreds of thousands of years ago. Our society has developed and advanced, but our bodies has not. And this is where it's actually quite important that now we're dealing with more abstract forms of stress. We're talking about financial stress, relationship problems, even more traumatic forms of stressors like bullying in schools. Those kind of stressors are what's actually creating our stress response. And this is typically what we call discomfort in our bodies, this actual activation of our physiological system.
So those social stresses, our body reacts to them the same as it would as if they were actual physical threats.
Absolutely. Yes.
That seems a little overwhelming.
It is. And the thing is, with when we're thinking about financial stress, relationship problems, studying for an exam, these day-to-day stressors, we're activating this physiological system over and over again. And this actually creates physiological dysregulation in our bodies, which then it manifests into different forms of diseases, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, heart attack, stroke. Those are the manifestation of day-to-day stressors that we have in our lives.
So a minute ago, our listeners heard another chuckle, so I'm going to bring in our other guest, Kayla Galvin, who is a yoga and meditation instructor with Equinox Sports Clubs and Evolve Power Yoga in Boston. Been on the show before. Kayla, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I'm going to start right there. We talked about the lion coming in, and I was like, no, thank you. And you chuckled at that. Are you more stressed? Are you feeling these social stressors? Does it feel like the world sicked a lion on you at any point in the last couple years?
Oh, yeah, I definitely get stressed here and there. I think I have tools to lessen the stress, but sometimes it gets away from me, right? Even as a yoga instructor, even as somebody who meditates, journals, has these tools in her back pocket, sometimes I don't use them.
And are you finding that the people you work with, the people you teach or coach, are expressing higher levels of stress, saying, hey, you know, I am feeling this in a way I didn't used to?
If they are, they're not expressing it to me. Usually my conversations with students after class are a little lighter. They don't get to that level. But I think people need yoga. People need meditation now more than ever.
So I'm going to start making the connections now, Adolfo and Kayla, in your work to help people begin to think about themselves, their bodies, and the systems that they're in, and what we can begin to do. So Adolfo, let's talk a little bit more about the physical manifestations of the impact of stress. So you've talked us through literally what happens in our bodies and how we might feel when we're stressed. But I understand that your research shows, and the research more broadly shows, there is a real cumulative effect to this.
Absolutely. Like we hold much of our experiences in our bodies, starting from the time we're born. And there's a lot of compelling research showing, in that vulnerable stage of life, of early life, people that have experienced physical abuse, psychological abuse, they hold those traumatic events in their bodies, and it actually begins to manifest later in life. And there's a lot of work on childhood adversity and how childhood adversity is associated with a wide range of psychological and physical disorders. Now, just to also imagine that's one type of stressor that people experience in day-to-day life starting early on. But then there's other forms of stressors that people experience: financial stress, workplace stress. And what I mean by workplace stress is really high job demand, low job control. Those are the kind of stressors that people tend to experience and accumulates. These experiences are embedded in ourselves, in our physical bodies.
So that can be really discouraging, Adolfo. It almost feels like sort of a kind of predetermination, or like the world and our systems are teaming up on a person. So where does agency fit? What can you control for yourself? What can you do for yourself? And what can't you?
I think that's the main question. And I think, I'll sound like a researcher here and say, it depends. You know, much of what stress exposure is, it depends on the individual and it depends on their surroundings. And the first thing that's important to keep in mind is that what we call stress appraisal is an important aspect to buffering the effects of stress on health. And what I mean by that is how we assess a situation determines how our body is going to respond. This all comes down to coping, how we actually view that particular situation, and then also what kind of resources are around us. Do we have supportive families? Do we have supportive friends? That will also determine how we view a particular event. So I'll give an example, a very innocuous example of if I were to present a pop quiz right now, and this pop quiz will determine whether you win $10 million. Well, and you really need those $10 million because it will resolve a lot of situations in your life. Well, you're going to experience high levels of stress. And it's mainly because you're seeing this particular situation as somewhat threatening to your overall survival in the future. But how about if you prepared for that exam? How about you were basically the night before you did some crunch time, you really, really studied all the particular items that might be in this potential pop quiz? You'll view that particular event as a challenge rather than a threat. And that because of the coping mechanisms and the social support they actually have.
Right.
We could apply the very same thing to our individual experiences of whether we could actually reappraise a particular situation. So if our boss yells at us, we could actually, rather than internalize it, create positive reappraisal, to increase positive emotions. Did I learn something from that situation? Or did I learn something about who they are as a supervisor? Or we could actually appraise it, or what, as they call negative reappraisal, which is ways to actually reduce negative emotions associated with that event by simply saying, well, my boss was having a hard day that day. And that really does reduce.
It physically reduces it.
Physically reduces it.
Yes. So let's stay in that space. And Kayla, I'll come to you now, because as I understand it, you know, a quieter mind, a more mindful presence gives you the skills to be able to do what Adolfo was just talking about. We have a question from one of our listeners who's in our texting group, Pat and okay. Wayland, who says, I don't really know how to meditate. I'd like to try to mitigate whatever present stress is probably doing to my body. Can the experts describe how to and how often or how long I should do that?
Okay. So there's kind of a public view of meditation as being this thing that's hard, or being this thing that you have to shut off your thoughts. And that's not really true. Actually, anybody can meditate. If you can sit quietly, you're meditating and you're doing it right. And you don't have to shut your thoughts off. You're human. You're always going to have thoughts.
Because my brain never shuts up.
That's okay.
Okay.
So the key to meditation is understanding that you're going to have these thoughts, but it's kind of like you want to almost pretend you're observing them from outside of your body. So you watch a thought come through, you notice it without judgment, you let it go.
What does it mean to notice it without judgment?
You just kind of give it understanding. You don't hyper-focus on it or try to attach a story or a narrative to it. You just see it for what it is, let it go.
So I might say, oh, look at that. I'm thinking blah, 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 rather than, oh, I'm thinking blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, right. Like, oh, this makes me an awful person because I'm experiencing this. I'm thinking this. I'm an awful. Like, no, actually, just a thought. Put it aside. Another one will come through, and that's that.
And what are some of the physical practices, Kayla, that we can do to help us kind of relieve stress?
Okay, yeah. So the mind likes to be still, but the body likes to be active. So there are a lot of almost physical mindfulness practices. We were talking about this before we came in, such as running, yoga, walking. If you're more creative, painting, really just kind of moving your body, and that kind of puts you in the position to slow your mind down after, or even during.
So it doesn't necessarily have to be strenuous exercise, and it doesn't necessarily have to be something that takes equipment in a place, in a group, just things that move your body and take you out of your head.
Exactly.
Adolfo, what do you do? I mean, you know stress so well. Are you like constantly checking your body? And what are you doing to help yourself with your stress?
I love running. And there's a cyclical relationship between running and stress, where people who are stressed are more likely to have sedentary lifestyles. And so one way to combat that is actually to be physically active. And then you're able to deal with stress later on. And so people have to understand that sometimes, as hard as it may be, being physically active does help you prepare for future stressful situations. And I love engaging in physical activity, just running for long periods of time. But I also, there's a dark side to my stress response. I love eating pizza. And so and there's a level of forgiveness that one has to give themselves as well when they're dealing with stress.
It's not so bad to eat a piece of pizza sometimes.
Oh, a piece? I eat a whole pie. But,
okay.
But
so you worry about the physical implications of that for your body.
Yes.
But a little bit of pizza, you know, if we're soothing ourselves and creating a better space for ourselves, not necessarily a bad thing. At least maybe that's what I'm hoping.
That's right. Yes.
All right. So Kayla, I'll come back to you. Tahir in Alston from our texting group says, pre-pandemic, I was handling stress great by swimming, training at the gym, and yoga. But since then, it's difficult to get back to it. So what's a baby step a person can take to begin to create a more mindful space for themselves that's not overwhelming to start with?
Yeah, so start slow, start with baby steps. So if they're looking to meditate, maybe just start with 3 minutes. You don't have to sit for 10 minutes, just 3 minutes. And I was reading the other day, it's easier to start a routine or pick up a new habit by attaching it to something that's already a habit. So a lot of people will meditate first thing in the morning because it's already a habit to wake up, or last thing before they go to bed, before they brush their teeth, they'll meditate because that's already in their schedule. It's already a habit. It's easier to attach that 3 minutes there. If they're looking to get to the gym, again, maybe getting to the gym takes too much time. Maybe you just throw on a 20-minute workout video and do it from your apartment, and that's great. You're moving your body for 20 minutes in your apartment.
Or maybe go for a walk.
Or go for a walk, yeah.
Excellent. All right, last question to you, Adolfo. What do you want us to say to ourselves? Based on the research, what you know, the next time we're paying attention to our thoughts, like Kayla says, and we think, huh, I am stressed.
Yeah, just being aware of your stress response is really important. And I think Kayla mentioned something quite important that transcends even outside of meditation, which is having no judgment of that response that you actually have to a stressful situation, given that that's your body telling you that there's something uncomfortable and there's something that you can actually do with that level of awareness. And so by approaching those stressful responses with no judgment, that's the important first step to engaging in addressing that issue.
All right. Adolfo Cuevas is a community psychologist and assistant professor of community health at Tufts University, and Kayla Galvin, who teaches yoga and meditation at Equinox and Evolve Studios in Boston. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For the next few weeks, every Wednesday, we are bringing you conversations on leadership. We call it Stepping Up, and we talk to local people making deep change in their communities. Last week, Doug Rao, food security pioneer, founder of the nonprofit grocery chain Daily Table. That was after spending 31 years with Trader Joe's, last 14 as president. This week, we want to look at a different angle, what it takes to serve your community with your heart and soul, especially in some of life's most challenging moments, those moments. Willie Bodrick II is here. He is senior pastor at the 12th Baptist Church in Roxbury. Reverend Bodrick, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me, Tiziana. It's good to be with you today.
It's great to have you. And when we first conceived of this series, you were one of the first people that I thought of that I wanted to talk to about your leadership journey and the call to be present in the way that you are. And so I actually just want to start, though, by saying, how are you?
I'm well. It's been a busy time, busy last few years. But, you know, as I'm continuing to push through these moments, as we're making it through it together, I think we're seeing some horizons, and hopefully we're working together to make that happen. But my family's well, and the church is doing well, and so we're thankful for that.
Good. As we planned this, it was before this weekend. And of course, then we have the grocery store shooting in Buffalo on Saturday. And you want to talk about a moment. And I guess I assume that that's something you have to address in your service, in your leadership, whether you want to or not, whether you're hurting or not, whether that's something you can handle in public or not. How do you get there?
Well, first and foremost, I think faith communities, particularly the church and the Black church, has always been a haven for tough conversations, particularly in times of trauma and deep grief. To be very honest with you, I was very angry this weekend, frustrated, but also angered, because we've seen the signs of this type of white supremacist violence and ideology not only be perpetuated, but end up with lives lost. If you put it in the grander context of American history, this isn't a new thing. It's just new in its form here in our particular context. And as you go into spaces of faith, you know that there are questions. People are grappling with emotions. They're grappling, as I told them Sunday, we're grappling with our faith and our frustrations. You're grappling with what to say. How do you manage those moments? How do you deal with those times? How do you process the trauma, whether near or far? How do you grapple with the fact that we no longer have safe spaces? And as leaders, we have to think in different ways. I remember when Charleston happened. You know, we're a church.
Shooting in a church in church Charleston.
In Charleston. And I won't name the perpetrator, but, you know, that was one that was very jarring for our community. And we were on high alert across the country, particularly as a historic church that could be targeted. And so we're thinking in new ways, but we're also deeply, deeply hurt by what's happening.
So many things I want to ask you just from literally the last two sentences that just came out of your mouth. So a couple of them quickly. Why not name the perpetrator of that other shooting?
I don't want to give power to that. I'd rather give power to those communities who are working together to process those real feelings, to validate their anger, validate their troubles, validate the trauma, validate the leadership that is rising in the communities where they are. I think we should not celebrate those who have levied this type of violence. And I think there's enough out there right now that creates an atmosphere to encourage, but we don't want to give power to that. We give power to communities. We give power to faith. We give power to those whom we love. And I think that's who should be lifted up. And I pray for those communities in Buffalo, but those communities all across the country who have dealt with that type of trauma and violence.
You made a reference to the fact that that was an historic church. Yours is an historic church. It is. And it's a church with a big pulpit to fill, given that Martin Luther King Jr. preached from that pulpit. Although sometimes I think when we emphasize that, we underemphasize the everyday leadership of all the other pastors who have preached at that pulpit as well. In a moment like this, how do you think about the weight of that historic leadership there and representation there?
I find it as an honor. I'm humbled by the fact, and I'm thankful for Dr. King. I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, originally. Yeah. So the King presence in Montreux is greatly both appreciated, but also I contextualize it, right? There's no King without William Hunter Hester, without Matthew A.N. Shaw. When you think about 12th Baptist Church, you can't talk about it without talking about Leonard Grimes in the 1840s and all the work that he did. You can't talk about it without George Washington Williams, who wrote the first anthologies of Black African-American history this country. You can't talk about it without talking about all the other pastors, Reverend Michael Lee Haynes, Reverend Arthur T. Gerald. And so I find it as an honor that I'm able to walk in the footsteps of those who come before me and to continue a tradition of justice, of faith, of for us, that faith in Jesus Christ, and using that as a means to both speak towards the issues of our day, to create community and convene, but to liberate people spiritually, socially, and emotionally. And as a church, we stand on the principles of love, light, life, and liberation, and we hopefully are working to do that work in our present time. So that's exciting. And I don't really feel the weight. I'm just thankful for the opportunity.
So I don't mean to be silly with what I'm going to say next. Fine. I know you were not expecting a Harry Potter reference in the middle of all of this, but when you talk about these men of spirit and men of faith and historians who came before you, I think about that moment in the last chapter of the Harry Potter story when he's got to confront death and the people who loved him who have passed are physically with him. And I think about when you were, I'm going to get a little choked up. I think when you were angry on Saturday. And I wonder, are they with you? And do they talk to you? Or do you talk to them? And how do you use that history to deal with your own anger and figure out how much of it as a leader, a faith leader, can and should be present in what you do next?
Yeah, I always consult first God and consult the spirit of the ancestors and what they've done to fight the moments in their day. We're dealing with different challenges, but their challenges were just as great for them. The decisions, the words that they spoke had impact on both community and country. And I think the presence and the spirit of that place, when you're in that pulpit, you're not alone. And I'm thankful that I never feel lonely doing this work because I walk in a tradition of people who have been willing to stand up, speak truth to power, put the community first, and to make sure that what is said speaks to what people are experiencing. And that's the beauty of the preaching moment, where you can speak and articulate and bring life to what people are feeling, to both have a conversation is what we're doing. We're having a conversation and we're praying that God is imbuing us to actually think critically about what we are to do. What is our Christian responsibility? What is our human responsibility, not only to each other, but to the community in which we are situated? And I think that has been the blessing. I would even argue it's a relief in some ways. That we are able to come together and be able to speak and to put that into the space and lift it before the God we serve. And knowing that that as we work together, as we continue to fight against those injustices, that we don't fight alone, and that we have a strong tower that keeps us strong in those moments.
What about breaking from the tradition when you need to, doing something differently than it's been? Especially, you know, eyes have been on you for a while because you're young. You get that youngin' thing, right? That people are pushing on all the time. And I don't know when that stops for you, by the way. You've been in leadership for long enough. I sometimes wonder, do we stop calling you young? I haven't stopped calling you young yet.
I'm hoping I'm still young.
But so how do you break? How do you break from those traditions when that's what the moment has called for?
I think you think deeply about what's needed for that moment. And one thing I've learned about leadership is leadership starts with love. Then it also ends in learning. But between the love and the learning, you got to be able to listen. I've listened. And I think because I've listened and I've loved and I've learned from people, when there have been moments where I've had to make decisions that break from tradition, that may be controversial, that may be different, people know where I am coming from. And I've been willing to engage those conversations in good faith, genuinely, openly, in community. And so, you know, I think of, you know, during COVID, we had a vaccination clinic in the basement of 12 Baptist Church. That was a very controversial topic.
Was it?
In our community, vaccines, period. Not only in the country, but in our community as well. And I knew that that was the right thing to do. I knew that we had to have those conversations. We did a fireside chat. You know, I don't have a beautiful studio, but I have a beautiful sanctuary where we brought in physicians. We brought in a physician to kind of answer live all the questions, and we stayed there as long as we needed to. It was on Facebook, it was on YouTube, it was on Instagram. We were there as long as needed to answer any questions, to correct any misinformation, to deal with the distrust, and to acknowledge the pain that the healthcare system has not always been a good partner to Black communities, particularly, and Brown communities as well. So we acknowledge that. We acknowledge the history as well as the present existence of how we're having difficulties engaging in community with our healthcare professionals. And so we don't want to disavow those people, but we also recognize that at the same time, this was a deadly moment. We were losing people throughout this pandemic. It was difficult. I funeralized many of people in ways that I think we have yet to even comprehend how that type of trauma of funeralizing people, where we did not have real meaningful departure. We did not always have ritual as we knew it.
Couldn't see each other. Couldn't say goodbye.
Zoom funerals. I did Zoom last rites. I was in a place one time. It was five people, and the majority of the family could not be there. I saw sons and daughters who contracted the virus right before the funeral who could not come and had to watch their loved one, their mother, their father, their aunt or their uncle, grandparent be buried over video. That has a meaningful, real impact on people. And I think we're going to have to do a lot of work of healing in order to kind of restore ourselves from that moment. But what I knew in this difficult moment was that we needed to be on the front lines. The church needed to be present, active, visible on the front lines. I was one of the first people to go take the vaccine because I wanted people to see not only is it safe, but I'm willing to do this myself. I want to be in partnership with you. And beyond that, not only did I want to myself to be an example of that, I want to say, look, I want to be in community and make sure that we as a church are committed to both healing and providing hope. And that healing does not stop at just spiritual healing. It's also physical healing. We have many stories in the Bible that speaks about this physical healing that Jesus Christ does throughout the Gospels. And so I wanted us to be a part of that work. And though it was controversial, I think it blessed our community. Almost 2,500 people almost were vaccinated in 12 Baptist Church because that was a safe space. We created a place of comfort, and there was a place, there was opportunity to build trust, and that trust was present with our community, and I'm thankful for that.
So undergirding what you just talked about is this idea of leading by example, right? You went and got the shot first. When you're a pastor, I can assume, I'm Catholic, I wasn't allowed to be one. But when you're a pastor, I can assume that that leading by example is a way of life. Mm-hmm. So where do you laugh? Where do you giggle? Where do you, go,
let me touch a little bit on both of these. I think leading by example is also leading honestly and leading integrally. That's saying I'm not perfect. That's been a thing that we've created in our society where we want these examples to be perfect. I'm not perfect. I don't even lead that way. I don't want to start leading that way. And being honest about my humanity, being honest that I need breaks, that I need safe spaces, that I need time away. That's something that I think some of my predecessors in history and the culture has not always permitted, which is why we see such extreme stress that has been placed on leadership across all spectrums of leadership. But I also think I have family. I have a loving, beautiful wife. She's a physician. She's always working as well. But I have a beautiful son who's almost 3 years old, and I love
named
him.
Named after Billy, you,
Willie Bodger III. I've done my job. I passed it on. And I have brothers. My brothers are here, Winston and Weldon. And I have family. I have friends. I have friends that I create safe spaces with that I do love. And I am intentional about making sure that I have time to be healthy. Because what I've learned is that if you're not healthy, you can't be healthy for others. And COVID taught me that. I did so many funerals to the point where I was deeply exhausted. And thank God for some of the people in my church, some of the mothers and some of the elders. They pulled me to the side and said, Rev, you're doing a great job, but we want you to stay doing a good job. And at the pace you're going, you won't make it. And that was a early sign for me to say, all right, I need to reevaluate how I'm doing this. The Superman model does not work. And the hardest part is being able to tell people, we can't do this time because I'm not healthy or I'm not ready. I can't overextend myself. And I think that's a tough lesson. But I think, you know, it's made it better because when I have the capacity, when I am ready, when I am healthiest, I think I produce and we produce some of our greatest work.
We have about a minute left.
That's it.
And I want to just touch for a second as a leader how you think about this moment in church and state in our country and how you talk about it.
I've been very blessed to get a great legal education from Northeastern University School of Law. Shout out to NUSL. And I think we can be very responsible in this moment. I don't think we want a theocracy. And I'm very clear about that as a person of faith who preaches who believes deeply in the word of God. And I think what we need to do is to be responsible as we think about the ways in which we are talking about our democracy, our legalism, the ways in which we're talking about faith. And we can have very, very engaged conversations that does not rip the rights of people away while at the same time affirm folks' faith. And I think we need to do a better job investigating our beliefs, but also do a better job of centering people. If we center people in this, I think we'll get to a better place.
That's Reverend Willie Bodrick II, senior pastor at 12th Baptist Church in Roxbury. Reverend, awesome. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Tiziana. I appreciate it being here.
That's our show for today, folks. Thanks for listening. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.